even at my age now, nearly 60, I still believe one day I'm going to find out what I really want to do.
I want to cry. I want to smile.
Once you get to Darwin, you either want to get out straight away because you can't stand the weather, or you fall in love with it. And of course, I fell in love with it.
Old, new, borrowed, blue.
On ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
Your guest tonight is musician, author, performance artist, Amanda Palmer. Her music has been much loved by Australian audiences since the early 2000s, when her band, the Dresden Dolls, released their first album. But last week was her first visit to the Northern Territory. Her old song for Old New Borrowed Blue tonight is The Beatles. Good evening, Amanda.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Where does that song take you?
Oh my God, that song takes me to being 5 years old and sitting in my parents' living room with gigantic headphones on my head. And my life was changed when I learned how to work the record player by myself. And I still needed a little bit of help, like flipping the record over and getting the needle in the right place. But I would sit and listen to that whole LP over and over and over and over again. It never got boring. And it still doesn't get boring. I have a four-year-old now, and I've been playing him that CD in the car on the drive to and from school. And I just don't get bored of that record. I get to the end and I go to the beginning and I'm like, nope, still not bored. 40 years later, still not bored.
What do you think it is about that album in particular?
It's just one of those rare cosmic collisions of brilliant songwriting, brilliant performance, and then astonishing production all in one package, like one of those records that only comes around, you know, once every generation or whatever. And yeah, and I never get sick of it. I never get sick of that song ever.
Do you have a record player at home at the moment?
I know
you're on the road, but...
Yeah, I don't carry one on the road.
No.
I'm not that rich. I have a couple at home. I have some cheapies, and then I've got one really nice one.
And do you still remember being taught, like, when you've got to move the needle and not touching the bottom? I think about my dad. I think every time I change a record about how I should be handling my record player.
You know, I think it was Brenda, our housekeeper, who taught me how to do it. My parents weren't actually that into music. It was one of those things where, like, there was a record player, and I think about that and I don't take it for granted anymore. You know, there didn't have to be one, but there was a record player, a little hi-fi in the house, and my mom's record collection. But my mom sort of had, I think her record collection sort of came from her past life. She and my dad split up when I was a baby, and when she shacked up with my stepfather, he didn't own any records or even tapes. He just wasn't a music listener. So she moved her whole record collection into the living room, but nobody touched it but me. And I gravitated towards it. That was the one room with the piano in it and the record player, and it was my sanctuary growing up.
Well, that's special then, if there was sort of no music all the time, to have a collection and a piano.
Yeah, and I mean, I talk about this in my touring show, but... You know, the older I get, the more fascinated I am by my own weird musical DNA and influences. And I can picture every vinyl sitting, you know, because my mom's record collection was not vast. And so she had all of the records by the doors, a couple of Beatles records, a couple of Rolling Stone records, which really fascinated me visually, but I really hated the music. I remember her Satanic Majesty's Request was like the coolest record cover ever, but every time I put it on, I was like, yeah, I want to listen to the Beatles. And then Fleetwood Mac and ABBA. And
That's a pretty great collection.
Yeah. And then that was it. My mom, you know, after that, it was like once a year she'd buy like a Phil Collins tape or something like that. She just sort of gave up on being a music listener, but also like she was holding down a full-time job with two kids and... you know, I think she really only listened to music in her car. She had the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack on tape that was played over and over again in the car.
Do you think that encouraged you to love it, something about it being special and just yours or your own time, music in that way?
No, actually, if anything, it was the opposite. I lived in this... You know, in this suburban world around this family who weren't really that into music, like no one ever really played music in the house. We didn't go, you know, there weren't music friends coming over. We didn't go to lots of music shows. It just wasn't really part of the process of growing up. But I really wanted it to be. And I lived in this fantasy in my head that, you know, if I could live in my alternate reality with my fantasy family and my fantasy parents, there would be music all the time and, you know, bohemian lifestyle and like musicians dropping by and crazy dinner parties and everyone playing guitar until 4 a.m. And that's the life that I have deliberately created for myself. Because I, you know, whatever it was about me, that's just what I wanted from a really early age. I wanted everyone hanging out together, making music, making art.
And what does your four-year-old think of that lifestyle in the home?
He seems to dig it, actually. Although something really fascinating happened the other day. Neil and I were in Melbourne and we went to go see Julia Donaldson, the children's writer who made The Gruffalo.
Yeah, The Gruffalo.
And
she's very important.
She's so great. And she was doing her kind of like live theater kids show for, you know, hundreds of kids and parents. And Neil knows her and was part of the literary festival. So the two of us show up with Ash and with a friend and her kid. And we sat in the front row because Julia Donaldson had saved us seats. And she needed volunteers constantly because, you know, like all these puppets and all these stories. And the first person she pulled out as her grown-up volunteer was Neil. And then the second person she pulled up was me. And Ash got really upset a couple of hours later. He didn't get upset at the moment. This is Ash, our four-year-old. And he started having a meltdown crying. And I said, do you want to tell me what's wrong? And he said, Dad, I went on stage. And I was like, what happens when Dada goes on stage? He goes, Dada shouldn't go on stage. I said, what happens when Dadas go on stage? He said, children get cross.
Oh.
And I was like, was it okay that I went on stage? And he was like, no. And like, there was this thing you could really see having to celebrated, you know, indie rock, indie author parents is really great at one level. And on another level, it was the first time my heart really skipped a beat. And I went, oh, man, he's going to really have to deal in a way that his peers just aren't going to have to deal. They're going to have their own problems with their parents, but he's going to have to compete for his parents' attention because we both sort of belong to the public. And that's whatever, you know, whatever his row to hoe is, that's the department that he's going to have to row.
Does he know that your job is being on stage? Does he think your job is being in the studio recording?
No, I'm pretty sure he thinks my job is getting on stage and playing piano for people because that's what he sees me do. Yeah. He doesn't ever really see me in the recording studio. And when he sees me sitting there on my laptop, you know, making Patreon posts and writing blogs and doing Twitter, none of that actually looks like anything real. So he thinks my job is to play piano for people and Dada's job is to write stories for people.
But not on the same stage and not taking away from Julia Donaldson, perhaps.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Let's see what happens in June. Neil and I are both about to go front the Boston Symphony Orchestra for two nights in a row. And I'm like, oh, it would be so great to have Ash come up and do something. But he's just on the cusp of like, that might not work. That might be a catastrophic idea.
Yeah, there's still some big emotions.
Yeah, for sure. But I also really believe in including him, you know, and a lot of people tell me off on the internet for sharing photos of him. And I feel like I really want him to be part of our community, and our community is big. But I want our community to care about him as much as we do. You know, I think that that's one of the weird push-pulls and measurements that you're constantly having to take as a person who's on the internet. But, you know, I'm not just an Instagram influencer and I'm not some celebrity. Like, I'm a person who comes from punk rock and has built up a community person by person going around the world for 20 years and being with people. Those are my people. They're not consumers. So I'm invested in them being invested in my child. It's important to me.
And you've been sharing with a lot of honesty your stories, your personal experiences from a very young age and before social media was what it is now.
Yeah. Well, before social media took the form of Twitter and Facebook, both Neil and I, actually separately before we met each other, had really big blogs back when you could have a quote unquote big blog, back when that's where people went on the internet. Like, that's the place that you had a destination and you went to people's blogs. And I loved blogging. I really loved the kind of wholeness of not just being on stage and doing this thing for, you know, a couple of hours at night, but having a real connection with my community and a constant conversation back and forth between me and the, you know, and the audience that I was building with the Dresden Dolls, which was my band. And in a weird way, social media was really exciting because all of a sudden it was fast and easy and you could find other artists. And I feel like I'm only just starting to wake up, like a lot of the world, to how damaging it's been and what we lost when we lost these really nice, you know, safe communities where everyone really trusted each other and it was much more civil. And now you
behaved like a community.
Yeah, it was more like walking into a pub and saying like, oh, hey, you're here. Oh, hey, what have you been up to? And everyone's sort of sharing this excitement of collective knowledge. And, you know, and now I find it really heartbreaking because I've been on, you know, for instance, on Twitter since 2006 or seven, and watching it disintegrate and watching it become, you know, a battleground is really, it's sort of like watching them come into your town and close down your little coffee shop and little pub and erect, you know, the Walmart or the Starbucks or whatever. It just feels like they've taken away something. But also, you know, people like me and Neil are also, you know, particularly me right now, I'm trying to turn things back around and I'm getting off social media and trying to create a, you know, it's a very low walled garden, but with my Patreon, I have 15,000 people who are all in one place. And the tools are still kind of clunky, but it reminds me of back in 2006 when it was just kind of nice being on the internet and people chatted and they helped each other and they supported each other and they looked at each other's art and it wasn't just about screaming your political opinion.
On ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory, you're hearing from Amanda Palmer. Amanda, have you noticed, before we talk about trolls and that side of things, has the audience and your community changed since the Dresden Doll days?
Sure it has, yeah. I mean, when Brian and I started the Dresden Dolls, it was just me and him. I was on piano, he was on drums, and I was 25. He was 22. And we were young. I'm 43 now. And, you know, we were a really loud, joyful, punk rock, aggressive, crazy looking band. And we, you know, we had a community of insane circus misfits and queers. And, you know, we were other everywhere we went. And we were joyfully loud and aggressive. And we loved it. And our band.
Was that with intent?
I mean, that was just
your expression.
That was just our style. You know, Brian and I, particularly, like, Brian and I were cut from the same musical cloth, but only in this Venn diagram. Like, Brian came from heavy metal and punk and jazz. Like, his top artists were Slayer, Metallica, you know, and, like, Elvin Jones and, you know, and Fugazi and stuff like that. And then I came from goth and singer-songwriter world and, you know, The Cure and Depeche Mode and more new wave stuff and esoteric stuff like Coil and Current 93 and these weird UK import bands making, you know, strange esoteric folk music. But we had this middle spot where we deeply overlapped with Nick Cave and The Doors and Swans and The Cure. You know, we both really loved loud, passionate music with soulful lyrics. And the Dresden Dolls were like this magical peanut butter and chocolate pairing of like, you would never think to put this chick with this guy. But when we found each other, we were magnetized. And the place that we created music from was really, really passionate. And you could feel it on stage. It's why the shows were so explosive. Like, Brian and I would get on stage and no one would be expecting a chick sitting down at a piano and a guy sitting down at drums to make that much noise and be that powerful. And we slaughtered people every night. But we were also really funny and we were really political and we really, you know, we were both outsiders growing up. So we really wanted to make a cabaret and a circus and a place where everyone could totally fly their freak flag because we had been denied you know? And this was also like the height of hipsterdom in Boston, Massachusetts, the town that we were living in. And every band was all male, plaid shirts, staring at the ground. And we were like, we're going to do it differently. We're going to make the band that we wanted to go see, where it was just all about radically inclusive communities and screaming at the top of your lungs and taking your clothes off if you needed to. And we did that, and people needed it and loved it. And you've also got to remember, this is 2001 and 2. So my band was born right where and when the World Trade Center came down. And everyone was just despondent and feeling all of this despair. And we came around and were like, come be with us. Let's just love each other loudly. And it was, and the Dresden Dolls were really an important band to a lot of people, including us. And then we toured the country, and then we toured the world 3 times. And we came here, and Australia embraced the Dresden Dolls in a way that no other country had. And that was really inspiring. And so it has changed because, you know, I went and made a solo record, and I still continued to tour with like a lot of people and a lot of help and a lot of circus and a lot of theater. But I also, you know, I got into crowdfunding. I got into an argument with my label, and I started being identified more and more as a sort of like an indie music entrepreneur. And I started writing more and more about my experiences and my feelings. And I mean, on this record in particular, it's funny, like looking back at Dresden Dolls songs from when I was 25, I'm not that different. I'm still telling a kind of a deep, passionate truth about my experience, especially my experience as a woman. And back when I was 25, I was talking about abortion and virginity and sexual assault and confusion and gender identity. And now I'm writing about miscarriage, like, you know, because I'm 20 years down the line and I've got a different set of experiences to draw on. But it's the same. I'm the same songwriter. But what has happened is, I think also without the bombast of the drums, and especially with an album like this and the TED Talk that I've done and the blogging that I've done, I've attracted a bigger female community. It's really interesting now going when I play with the Dresden Dolls, because we do reunite and we're about to do a big reunion. There's almost a 50-50 gender split, whereas, you know, on this solo tour, it's more like 70-30. And I'm just attracting all of these women, but mostly because, like, I'm a woman talking about what it's like being a woman right now, and women are really digging hearing that.
And kudos to the men that want to hear that and be in that conversation as well. But we do have to pause to listen to another song in just a moment.
Rebecca McLaren.
A very good show.
On ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
Joined by Amanda Palmer for Old New Borrowed Blue. Amanda, we do have to pause our conversation to hear your new song, What Have You Chosen?
This is one of my favorite newly discovered artists named, her name is Torres. That's the name she records under. And this is actually one of those great stories that I can't believe is actually true. But I was staying in a hotel in New York City that happened to have vinyl and a turntable in the room. And I was just flipping through the records, and I'd sort of heard of her, so I put the record on. And when this song came on, I stopped what I was doing, and my jaw dropped, and I just sat there and then moved the needle back and listened to it 3 more times. It's so good.
Thank you for bringing that song in, Amanda. It's really beautiful.
It is gorgeous.
I listen to music a lot in the background while I'm doing things, and to find a song that really makes you stop and listen, that's special.
Yeah, and I also find as I get older, I find less and less music that works. It's sort of, I feel like a junkie who's just like already used every vein. And it's just like, what's going to work? And then when you find something that really works, you know, I actually find myself feeling absolutely no shame about listening to music over and over and over again when it's you know, works as a main line.
Amanda, I have trouble saying I'm talking to Amanda Palmer because in my mind, I want to swear in the middle of it because you are known as Amanda Effing Palmer. I really like that. Do you like that?
Yeah, I took that as my own nickname. It was hurled at me as an insult by someone that I cannot by someone that I cannot name while I was making a record with someone that I cannot name.
Oh.
But it was really like it was meant to be this like disparaging, like, oh my God, man, Palmer. And then I was like, that's actually pretty good.
Yeah.
I'm gonna use that. So Ani DiFranco did it before me though. She had shirts that said Ani effing DiFranco as merch back in the 90s.
Yeah, right.
I can't claim to be original.
We were talking about your mum's record collection and being fairly limited. What sort of music are you making sure is in the house for Ash as he's growing up that you want him to be hearing?
Oh my God. So this is where I feel like I'm failing as a parent, because like if you had told me that as a musician I was going to have a kid and that they would be into listening to music, I would have assumed that I would be like deeply, passionately curating all of this stuff for him to listen to. And that's just not happened. It's just like, and especially I've been on the road. So when you're on the road, it's just like songs kind of come into his consciousness or come in through movies or through some television show that he watched or something that a babysitter played. And since he's a kid, he just wants to hear the songs that he likes. So I actually find myself doing what I actually have always done with my own music collection and taste, which is I just sort of follow the bouncing ball and I'm not very deliberate about it. So, you know, I played yesterday over breakfast, I played him the William Tell Overture, and then we listened to Zombie Jamboree, and we listened to the Pink Elephant song from Dumbo. And he just makes requests, and I find them on YouTube and stick them up on the shelf so he doesn't think that there's a screen involved. And that's the extent of my DJ curating for my son. But I think it also doesn't matter. I think music is music. I think as long as kids are listening to music, there is no bad music. I don't believe in bad music, you know, and I actually think the more varied your musical palette is as a developing listener, the better. So like I am fine with everything from Britney Spears to Harry Belafonte to classical music to whatever commercial jingle he may have picked up, because it's all just sound. It's music and it's all good.
If music wasn't so celebrated when you were growing up, when did you start writing and making your own or even thinking about that?
Well, interestingly, you know, it's not like music wasn't celebrated. My parents were, you know, they were like good Massachusetts, you know, card-carrying liberals who read The New Yorker, and they appreciated music. And my mom really did love music. She was in the church choir, and she obviously had a passion for music, even if she wasn't an artist or a composer. My stepdad grew up in a house without music, and his father was actually quite sick when he was young, and so there wasn't even any music allowed in the house. And I think he saw music as more of kind of an alien planet, whereas my mom was into it. My parents never discouraged me at all. In fact, they, you know, with a really light touch, they encouraged my exploration into music making and composing, even though it drove them nuts. Like the piano was under their bedroom and I would want to play at all hours. And that led to a lot of screaming arguments, you know, them going, we have to work in the morning, and me going, but I must compose. There was a level at which I knew they would be proud of me. Unlike a lot of my musician friends, my parents never took me aside and said, okay, but let's get serious.
What's your real job going to be?
They expressed some concern. Once I got into my 20s and I was like, no, I mean it. I'm going to do this. And they were like, ooh, well, do you have a plan B? Because we're a little worried about you. But I think that they also looked at my stubbornness and they knew that trying to talk me out of it was pointless. And also, I was a really hard worker. I was really committed to being an artist, and I put the hours in. So I think they knew, you know, that I was really headstrong, and if I wanted to do something, I was probably going to figure out a way to do it.
Do you remember the first song or the first thing you had to say?
Oh, what a way to word it. I mean, most of the first things that I had to say were copies of the music I was listening to. So, you know, as a 12-year-old songwriter listening to the Thompson Twins and Madonna and Cyndi Lauper, I just assumed that I needed to write songs about the other 12-year-old boy that I had a crush on who wouldn't look at me when I deliberately hung out near his locker. Like that's just what I thought you did. I just thought you wrote songs about that and yearning and love, and that was the palette, but that was mostly the palette I was fed. And then the first really good song I wrote, I didn't write my first good song until I was about 15. And what I had to say in that song was really dark. It was about the murky gray area of sexual assault and sexual tension and the situations that you put yourself into and whether what happened was good or bad or your fault or okay or, you know, and that was really good songwriting material because I couldn't really articulate that for anyone else. I couldn't articulate those feelings to my parents. I couldn't really articulate them to my friends. But I had been taught by the music I was listening to, especially the dark stuff, the Nick Cave stuff and the Cure stuff, that working from that palette was actually, you know, a door you were allowed to open. It was a good place to experiment with talking about the dark.
And is that a song that you just wrote for yourself? Or is that a song that you...
Believe it or not, 11 years later, 12 years later, that song made it onto the first Dresden and Dolls record.
Right. The conversation was well and truly started with that community that you were creating about things that had happened to you.
Yeah, I mean, that first Dresden and Dolls record that launched us into indie fame or whatever, you know, the first record that we toured over here in Australia and that was getting played on Triple J and stuff all the time. I don't know how many people outside our hardcore fan base really realized, like, those songs were incredibly, incredibly dark. Coin Operated Boy and Girl Anachronism, which were the singles, you know, they were sort of darkish, but you listen to the rest of that record and, oh my God, it's like, it's pretty brutal. But also, you know, it had enough punk energy and enough humor in it that it was palatable. You know, it wasn't all doom and gloom.
It's time to pause for your borrowed song. Amanda, what have you chosen?
Oh, this is a good borrow. So I just did this Bushfire benefit record that I recorded really fast a couple weeks ago. I mean, and when I say really fast, like I slammed it out and learned and arranged these songs in about a week.
Wow.
But also I was really lucky. I had friends in Melbourne. I called up Missy Higgins. I called up Claire Bowditch. I called up Fred Leone. All of a sudden, everyone raced into the studio.
I'm going to steal your phone later.
Oh, my phone is filled with goodness. And I went to my community. I went to my Australian patrons and I said, feed me ideas. I want songs that really actually speak to the bushfires politically, besides the obvious stuff, besides Beds Are Burning. We can definitely do that, but give me the deep stuff. And someone suggested, well, first of all, there was a big faction of people who insisted that I do Solid Rock by Goanna.
Yes.
And that was actually really hard to pull off on piano, but I did it.
Well done.
And someone sent in this song by Emily Waramura called Black Smoke, and it was just so beautiful. And it sat so beautifully, like within all of these angrier political songs. And I called up Claire Bowditch and I said, will you please, I don't know if you know this song. And she's like, not only do I know this song, I've toured with Emily, let's do it. So she got into the studio with me, and Claire's vocals on this, actually, like, I was sitting there in the studio while she tracked them, and I started to cry because I felt like she was just delivering this lullaby to a charred Australia with her, like, beautiful, soothing, maternal, it's going to be okay kind of voice. And I just, this, even listening back to it the last few times because the record has just come out, it still makes me a little teary.
A beautiful cover and so appropriate for you to choose to share with us because Emily is from Groote Eylandt, from the Top End. I know this is your first visit to the Top End, Amanda. Are you taking some time to explore, get outside of Darwin?
I am. I actually deliberately came here a day early and I'm deliberately leaving a day late so that I can poke around. And also I'm really excited that I'm here on the weekend. So I'm going to go to the markets on Sunday. I'm going to try really hard to find a good piano bar, maybe somewhere.
Good luck to you.
Yeah. You know, it might just have to be ukulele on the beach, but we can deal with ukulele on the beach. Yeah. I mean, I've been traveling and touring Australia for 15 years, but Darwin's far. So it never, like, even when I insisted, when I put out my Amanda Palmer Goes Down Under record, which was sort of my first big set of love songs for Australia, I told my agents, like, I want to go everywhere. You know, you've got me for 2 months. Like, send me to Darwin, send me to Cairns, send me everywhere. I said, I want to go to Cooper Petey. And they waited forever. And then at the very 11th hour, they sent me the whole touring list. And it was Sydney, Melbourne, Perth, Adelaide, and Brisbane. And I was like, I'm going to kill you. And that was, and, you know, I really flexed my ninja muscles on that tour. And I just reached out to my community and I said, I will play anywhere. Just find me a piano, find me a bar. And I booked gigs in Newcastle and in Geraldton and in Lismore and all these weird places. And Tasmania, that was the first time, you know, someone put their hand up for Tasmania. But, you know, it's a big country. And
that's the next step from self-managing a tour to getting your fans to organize it, or, you know, to put their hands up to help you.
Yeah. Well, when I did my Kickstarter back in 2012, I sold house parties and I went to places on the globe that I never thought I would see, you know, in the middle of nowhere, rural Canada and Germany and Israel and like all of these bizarro places and places without venues where people were just like, we just want you to come. Let's just figure it out. And I love that. I mean, this sort of gets back to what it feels like to be part of a community instead of just a star who's a product with fans who are consumers. Like, my community and my audience feel like they feel like friends.
And given the nature of this current tour and this current album and the things that you're talking about, are those friends reaching out to you for support?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this has been a really interesting and fascinating tour in terms of what it feels like to be in this community. I started recording this record 2 years ago and, you know, I had been blogging and chronicling a lot of what I had gone through. You know, I've been talking openly about abortion for over a decade. But I really laid my experiences bare on this record and in this tour. And it's scary. Like, it's really scary to get up on stage and talk so openly about such really sort of like creepy, personal, intimate stuff. But it's a two-way street. And I, you know, every time I get up there and do it, I'm greeted with all of these like tearful nods of recognition from the people sitting in the seats. So I know it's not just me. And I still try to sign after most of my shows, and I hear so many stories every night from women and men and people of all ages and genders and shapes and sizes just telling me that they're so happy that I'm up there talking about it, because it's not my story. It's everybody's story practically. And it's also, you know, ending this tour in Australia feels really beautiful because the community, you know, they know that I'm just kind of bopping around on stages, but they're all sort of connected to each other. And when I landed here and the bushfires were happening, one of the first things that happened is my patrons from all over the globe said, you know, Amanda, take our money and give it to Australia. Just do something, do anything, record a cover song, whatever, because I'm crowdfunded permanently. So I have access to all of their credit cards. And I was like, okay, like let's go. And in that sense, I feel like I've really, you know, I've earned a lot of trust. I've been doing this for 20 years, but to be able to just like grab an armload of thousands of dollars and give it to a charity in Australia because these people trust me feels like, that sort of feels like the fruit of my labor sometimes, is that we sit down and we talk about all this stuff that's real, but then all of a sudden like real reality crashes in the door and everyone really helps, and it's beautiful.
There's something in the collective experience in no longer feeling alone with your pain or what you've endured. But is that sometimes, do you feel like you're carrying those other experiences? Are there ever stories that are too much for you?
So I did a confession booth at the Mona Foma Festival where I sat one-on-one and totally, you know, confidentially with people in a little booth in the park. You know, it was a quote-unquote confessional booth, but people could just talk about anything they wanted. And I talked to almost 100 people in Launceston, Tasmania, the bottom end. The opposite side. And it was, you know, I spent 3 days in that booth, about 12 or 14 hours just listening to people. And I heard some incredibly, incredibly heavy stories. And there was a lot of sadness and a lot of abuse and a lot of rape and a lot of, it was just so, 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 so dark and so much loss. But then I turned around on day four and I set myself to the task of writing a song. And I've been doing this job for long enough that I've gotten pretty good at synthesizing. Like, I can take on all of that pain. I can know that the pain is real and that it's kind of a
collective pain. And
you cry
when you're hearing it?
Oh my God, I cried with so many people. I mean, there were a lot of moments in that confession booth where there just wasn't any talking and it was just two sobbing people hanging on to each other because, you know, and not every person, but sometimes the truth of people's pasts can be so unbearable, especially when you know that the stories are unshared because they're too dangerous or too indicting or whatever. And I mean, but none of it felt bad. Any moment that I could feel like I was providing a single person some kind of relief felt positive. And then also to know that I would get to unburden myself back into the music and then back into the community to offer something, not just sit there and have to hold it, but then go into the studio and write a song, which wound up on the Bushfire album because it was interrelated, because everyone was freaking out about everything being on fire. Like, you couldn't separate these two topics. So I wrote this song called Suck It Up Buttercup that was also sort of folded in the literacy rate of Tasmania and folded in, you know, the genocide of the original landholders of Tasmania, and everything just sort of fit together. And I feel like that's my job. I feel like if we're good artists, that's what we do. We're good at taking on pain and somehow releasing it for the collective good, not just because we need the catharsis, but because everyone always needs it.
Well, speaking of tears, I suspect that your blue song will take us there. What have you chosen, Amanda?
Oh, this is one of my favorite songs by one of my favorite artists of all time. This is Regina Spektor, another piano singer, songwriter, composer. And she used to open up for the Dresden Dolls. We were babies together back in 2003 and 2004 when we were just touring Boston and New York. And she was from New York and we were from a couple hours away and we would tour together. And she was just one of those artists where the first time I heard her music, I knew she was going to be, if the universe was fair, I knew that she was going to be massive because she had such a gorgeous, explosive, and unique voice. And this is from, I think, her third or fourth record. The record's called Far. And it just shows off her prowess as a lyricist beautifully. And luckily, it's got the word blue in it, so we're allowed to use it.
Thank you so much for spending some time with us tonight, Amanda. It's been wonderful.
Thank you. And please go, if you're listening, go get the Bushfire album. It's called 45 Degrees. You can just Google it. It's on my Bandcamp, and all of the money is going to Fire Sticks Alliance, which is this great Indigenous charity in Victoria.
ABC Radio, Darwin.
Don't forget that.